Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the U.S. Secretary of State is moved by a visit to the Hiroshima Memorial. South Korea announces the defection of a North Korean military officer. An author offers advice to U.S. voters.
The best government is about making a better life for all Americans.
And the soulful pop band Lucas Graham touches a nerve with music. It's all right here on The Voice of America. The foreign ministers of the Group of Seven Industrial Democracies today issued a joint declaration in Japan calling for a world without nuclear weapons. The so-called Hiroshima Declaration cited the security situations in Syria and Ukraine, as well as North Korea's repeated violations of bans on its nuclear and missile tests, as impediments to that vision. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry today became one of the highest-ranking American officials, along with his counterparts from Germany, Italy, Britain, Japan, Canada, and France, to visit Hiroshima, where the United States dropped the first atomic bomb to end World War II 71 years ago. It raises expectations President Obama will do the same in May when G7 leaders meet. Before visiting Hiroshima's Peace Memorial and Museum, as well as the atomic bomb dome at Ground Zero, Kerry spoke of the significance of his participation.
My visit to Hiroshima has a very special meaning about the strength of the relationship and the journey that we have traveled together since the difficult time of the war. So I will be pleased to visit later today the Peace Memorial, the park, in a moment that I hope will underscore to the world the importance of peace and the importance of strong allies working together to make the world safer, and ultimately we hope to be able to rid the world of weapons of mass destruction.
Kerry said the visit is not about the past, but about the present and future, and the strength of the relationship between the U.S. and Japan, as well as the imperative to work for world peace. Sunday, the seven ministers discussed global issues, including the regional threats posed by China's growing presence in the South China Sea and North Korea's nuclear and missiles programs. Japanese security analyst Yoichiro Sato of Ritz-Makan Asia Pacific University told VOA's Victor Beatty the G7 ministers have already issued a statement on China's recent moves in the South China Sea.
They are collectively against China's attempt to forcefully change the status quo. It clearly refers to the land reclamation by China and deployment of missiles onto these reclaimed bases. North Korea is also a problem because there have been signs that North is testing new missiles, and they also announced that they developed a new booster for a ballistic missile, which suspectedly makes improvement to North's ability to launch missiles against the U.S. mainland.
Of course, Japan is hosting this G7 summit coming up later this year. This obviously is going to put a focus on Japan.
Yeah, this is a very important event for Prime Minister Abe, as China's rise has somewhat cast shadow on Japan's regional leadership. This is very important for Japan to demonstrate to the world that Japan is part of G7 and China is not. This is also important because the visit to Hiroshima symbolizes the solidarity of the Western world, and this really contrasts last year's efforts by China and Russia to turn the 70-year anniversary of the World War II's end into some sort of propaganda to claim that both China and Russia were victors of the World War II, therefore they were entitled to take major part in the global management of international relations. So Japan is actually given the opportunity to kind of reverse that this year.
Mr. Kerry's been asked whether or not the U.S. plans to apologize for the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. The U.S. has responded by saying no, but the mere presence of the Secretary of State, first one to visit Hiroshima, and President Obama's possible visit to Hiroshima, this is pretty significant.
Yes, I think Kerry's visit is kind of a testing of the water. The Japanese side hasn't really asked for an apology as such. And it's a matter of significance in the sense that this is going to be the first visit, but also it symbolizes the consolidation of the U.S.-Japan alliance.
Yoichiro Sato says a visit to Hiroshima by President Obama in his final year in office would bring his concern about nuclear proliferation full circle, following his speech on the issue shortly after taking office in 2009. And with a look at what's being said on the web today concerning this story is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky here at the Anchor Desk. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
So what are they saying?
Well, there's a lot of talk about this visit to Hiroshima. And what's interesting when you look at this is that the languages in which this event's being spoken in, you see English, of course, on social media, but you're seeing Japanese, Korean, Russian, French. So there's a lot of interest in this around the world. Of course, the G7 is a global entity, so you're seeing a lot of global interest. And the nice thing about social media, specifically Twitter, is that you can translate these comments within Twitter.
So you How do you do that?
There's a button that says, view translation. You click on that.
That's complicated.
But it pulls it up in whatever your native language is. So there was one comment that I saw that was in Japanese that I was able to translate using this function. And I thought it was kind of poignant. It said, finally, these G7 ministers are realizing the cruelty of nuclear weapons. The fact that they're seeing it with their own eyes is of great significance. So I think that's a sentiment being shared by a lot of people around the world, but especially those in Japan. Certainly a momentous moment for them.
Yes, we were just talking how Kerry was so affected by visiting that memorial.
Yeah.
But you have some other stuff for us today, too.
Yeah. So over the weekend, it was hashtag National Siblings Day. And I love these national days because they never say what nation it is. It presumably starts in the U.S., but then it kind of spreads all over the world. Mm-hmm. So you see tweets from around the world about National Sibling Day over the weekend. You saw some famous siblings, like as a tennis fan, Venus and Serena Williams. You
yes.
saw them tweeting about it and putting it up on Instagram. And then my friend's siblings, my own brothers, putting up things on Instagram saying happy National Siblings Day. It's a nice way to commemorate brothers and sisters around the world. And then today is hashtag National Pet Day.
Which I think is pretty much the same thing.
For some siblings it is, but I just think this is funny because we have, National Dog Day, National Puppy Day, now we have National Pet Day, and it's, of course, being dominated by all the dogs. So the dogs get a lot of love, but we're seeing also people posting cats, birds, even bunnies and goldfish. So a nice way to celebrate pets of all types.
That's great. That's great. Well, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers from Vanderbilt and Harvard universities have discovered a binary star system nearly 10,000 light years from Earth, where it takes 69 years for one of its stars to eclipse the other. But once it does, the eclipse lasts for 3.5 years. The researchers described their findings in a paper that's been accepted for publication in the Astronomical Journal. This star system, which has no official name, has set a new record for having both the longest duration stellar eclipse and the longest period between eclipses in a binary system. Until this discovery, the previous record holder was Epsilon Origae, an eclipsing binary system that is only 2,000 light years from Earth. That star system's yellow giant star is eclipsed by its normal-sized companion, that's slightly bigger than our sun, for 640 to 730 days every 27 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
South Korea says a high-ranking North Korean military officer defected to the South last year. On the line with us from Seoul is correspondent Brian Padden. Hi there, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. How are you?
All right, doing fine.
Good, good. Say, what can you tell us about this case?
So the South Korean government announced today that a high-ranking North Korean colonel from North Korea spy agency defected to South Korea, but gave very few details after that. There's a lot of speculation here, especially from opposition parties, that this is very politically motivated, announcing this defection at this time, just days ahead of major legislative elections where the opposition has the upper hand when it comes to economic issues, because South Korea is not performing as well economically. But on national security issues, President Park Geun-hye's Sanori Party seems to resonate more with the people for its strong stand against North Korea. So there's a lot of skepticism in that. Also, when you read into this, there's no real details, but there's also been some reporting that this defection happened last year. So this was before the fourth nuclear test. And it happened a week after I spoke with a high-ranking official in the South Korean government who said that that the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, is firmly in control of that government. So if there was some sort of indication that these recent defections are indicating some instability within Pyongyang, South Korean officials themselves have contradicted that just a days ago. And to have a high-ranking military officer suddenly, not suddenly defect, but announce his defection just days before an election leaves a lot of people wondering about the motivation behind this. Also, in the past, South Korea has not announced these type of defections publicly very often. Now, from the Seoul government's perspective, perhaps it's a change in policy here as well, because before the recent nuclear test and a missile launch in February, the South Korean government was trying to find some way to engage in talks and try to bring the North along into some sort of long-term partnership to work towards unification. How can we kind of de-escalate tensions and work together type of strategy, whereas now Seoul is much more positioned to say that the line has been drawn in the sand, and until North Korea changes its behavior, nothing is going to change. So there's no incentive for South Korea to hold back the names of these defections.
So you think that there's a possibility that the South Korean government announced this because it would look good for them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The timing of it makes one curious. If this high-ranking colonel defected last year and they're announcing it 2 days before an election, that makes you skeptical. Now, the other recent announcement that there were 13 employees of a North Korean restaurant last week who defected, that seemed to be more candid because it happened just then. But just the timing of it this week seems to kind of add to perhaps some sort of political motivation and attempt to manipulate news coverage.
Well, thank you very much, Brian, for your insight.
Okay, thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, a U.S. author looks back to look forward in U.S. politics. And the song, 7 Years, touches a nerve. There was a time in America when politics worked, to quote a release from publisher Basic Books. It says, in the 1960s, when Lyndon Johnson was president, the U.S. Congress passed more than 1,000 pieces of legislation collectively known as the Great Society. Randall B. Woods has written a book about this era called Prisoners of Hope, and he joins us on the line. Welcome, Randall.
Thank you, Susan.
Why do you believe things worked back then in the United States?
Lyndon Johnson was one of the least partisan presidents in American history. When he was Senate Majority Leader, he led the Democratic majorities in Congress and insisted that they cooperate with the Eisenhower administration rather than trying to obstruct. When he became president, that paid off. And in fact, in the 64 election, he got more Republican votes than Barry Goldwater did. And in that day and time in Congress, people were not surrounded by large entourages. They knew each other personally, and even people on the opposite end of the political spectrum had respect for each other.
Are today's Democrats and Republicans still fighting over the same issues as they did 50 years ago?
Absolutely. Part of the Voting Rights Act was passed in '64, and of course the Supreme Court has moved to cut back on its guarantees. The Immigration Act of 1965 did away with the national origins basis of immigration policy, and of course, immigration is a major debate today. Part of the Great Society was the passage of Medicare, and the government's role in health guarantees is a major topic today with Obamacare. Federal aid education was part of the Great Society, and we're talking about standards today, so it just sort of goes on and on.
Well, how can the actions of the Johnson period be applied to the current race for the White House?
Well, I think that in many ways, the Democrats since the 60s have distanced themselves from Johnson and even the Great Society because of Vietnam. Liberals were completely turned off by that. Hillary Clinton is the only presidential candidate ever to have mentioned Lyndon Johnson's name in public. And that's probably fitting because her brand of liberalism really represents his brand of liberalism. That is, equality of opportunity, job training, regulated capitalism, bipartisanship, and that search for political centrism is really under assault from both the left, Bernie Sanders, and from the right. I don't know if Donald Trump is on the right or not. I don't know where he is, but certainly from Ted Cruz and Rubio and the Tea Party people.
Well, what would you want a reader to walk away with after going through your book?
That the best government is about making a better life for all Americans, and that you can have a social and economic floor, guaranteeing health care, job opportunities for people, without destroying free enterprise and democracy.
And the name of your book again?
Prisoners of Hope, Lyndon Johnson, The Great Society, and the Limits of Liberalism.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today, Randall.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Danish singer-songwriter Lukas Graham Forsheimer has broken through with his hit 7 Years, which recently reached number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100 music chart. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the soulful pop band Lukas Graham has touched a nerve with the song.
Once I was 7 years old, my mama told me, go make yourself some friends or you'll be lonely.
Lukas Graham Forsheimer says he always wanted to release his pop soul music in the United States. He had success in Europe and in Australia, but it wasn't until the hit 7 Years that the Danish-born singer saw his dream come true.
I've always wanted to release in America. That's where I believe the music belongs, the style. And the eclectic musical mix that we've put together kind of belongs here. This is where most of the genres are from, all the rap and soul and rock and roll, most of it anyway.
Forsheimer grew up in Christiania, Denmark, a self-governed neighborhood in Copenhagen known for Pusher Street, where dealers peddle marijuana. But it also has a tight-knit community. And he and his boys, bandmates Mark Lovestick Falgren on drums, Casper Dalgaard on keys and Magnus Magnum Larsen on bass, are currently on a North American tour. Lukas says he wants to touch audiences with his music And he can see from the stage when a song affects someone.
Like when I make people cry, when I sing 7 years or Better Than Yourself, Happy Home, You're Not There, all these big ballads about loss and pain and family and experience and life, I'm like, that person gets it. And if someone's not crying, I'll be like, okay, so that person hasn't gone through that experience yet. Give her 5 years. She'll get it. Eventually, everybody gets it.
The 27-year-old Danish singer says that the song 7 years wasn't intentional. It grew out of a recording session when his producer was just playing some chords on the piano.
Rizzy Rizzy, my main producer, started playing the piano. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And I just started singing, once I was 7 years old, my... And then he was like, well, that's good, keep going. And I'm like, once I was 7 years old, my mama told me go. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's good. And we're just 3.5 hours later, the song was done.
Lucas Graham Forshammer studied law before deciding to pursue music. He says his experience growing up in Christiania made him want to make a difference in people's lives. But now he's doing it with his music. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Once I was 7 years old.
Danny Willett is only the second man from England to win the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta, Georgia, but it was the monumental collapse of defending champion Jordan Spieth of the United States, who had led after each of the first three rounds, that will surely be talked about for years to come. To invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Navy announced this month that it had seized a ship laden with illegal weapons in the Persian Gulf that were likely bound for Houthi fighters in Yemen. It was the latest in a string of illicit weapons shipments seized in the region by naval forces and assessed by the U.S. to have originated in Iran. Distributing illegal weapons is part of a pattern of destabilizing behavior by Iran that remains a challenge for the United States and its regional allies. In testimony before Congress, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Thomas Shannon said the United States has been encouraged by Iran's adherence so far to the commitments it had made under the nuclear deal with the P5+1, the JCPOA. But he noted that profound differences with Iran remain and continue to be addressed.
Iran's support for terrorist groups like Hezbollah, its assistance to the Assad regime in Syria, and to Houthi rebels in Yemen are at odds with core U.S. interests and pose fundamental threats to the region and beyond. That's why we have retained our sanctions related to Iran's destabilizing activities in the region, including its support for terrorism.
In addition, Undersecretary Shannon expressed concern over Iran's attempts to develop increasingly capable ballistic missile systems and said the U.S. would use all available multilateral and unilateral tools to impede the development of Iran's missile program. Iran's violations of the fundamental rights of its citizens were also cited by the undersecretary, who noted that rights-related sanctions are not subject to relief under the JCPOA, and the U.S. continues to vigorously enforce these sanctions. At a recent press conference in Bahrain, Secretary of State John Kerry urged Iran to change its destabilizing behavior. We call on Iran, said Secretary Kerry, to prove to the world it wants to be a constructive member of the international community and contribute to peace and security, and to help us end the war in Yemen, not prolong it. Help us to end the war in Syria, not intensify it, and help us to be able to change the dynamics of this region, which needs space to begin to breathe, to engage in full economic activity, put people to work, send people to school, do things other than constantly be caught up in the instability that comes with either sectarian or ideological extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.